This is Forces Radio BFBS. The following programme contains adult themes. Forces Radio.
This is Forces Radio.
This is BFBS.
FBS, original Forces programmes.
Coming home, Chris Thrall.
Things were pretty fraught. I mean, I was a guy that just got kicked out of working for the Hong Kong Triads because I was too crazy. And I mean, I was literally crazy. I don't mean my behaviour was wild, although it was. I mean, I was just so mentally unwell, they couldn't deal with it anymore. They had to let me go. Was always was just smoking a bit more of a drug or doing this, and I would always make sure I'd polish my boots when I went out and I'd have a wash, you know. I always stuck to my core marine principles, as it were. But I was too messed up on the drugs to hold it together, and I just couldn't. My upbringing was pretty challenging. You could say I grew up an angry young man. And I had a friend when I grew up. He came around to my house and he said, yeah, I've just joined the Royal Marines. You know, I've been on this potential recruit course. It was so difficult. They made us do this. They made us do that. And then he said, of course, you couldn't do it. And being this angry young man, I said, well, yeah, I could. As soon as the break was over, I went straight down to the recruiting office. My friend had told me what to say. He said, you need to say, I want to forward an application to join the Royal Marines. I don't know why we decided that was the thing that I had to say, as opposed to, you know, can I join the Marines, please? But the sergeant in the recruiting office, he didn't say anything. And the sergeant said, yeah, just can you jump up on that pull-up bar? So as with everything you do in the Marines, you think you're going to fail. You're going to give it your best, but you there's this, always this massive worry that you're not good enough, and that's obviously how you're made to feel to get the best out of you. So I got to like my 29th pull-up, and he's like, right, get down. I was like, all right, I've obviously failed. And then I later realised, like, most guys have trouble doing five or six, or as civilians, obviously. And that was it. Of course, all the time, I was this angry young man, so I was running the endurance course. You do it in, like, order, then you're not, obviously you don't have equipment and a weapon. But I'm running endurance course, and I was starting to fall back from the pack, and this corporal came alongside. Come on, mate, you can do it. And I just thought, I'm not going home. That's all I ever thought during all my time was, I'm not going home. I'm not going to give my parents, who kicked me out, my mother kicked me out at 15, father then kicked me out at 17, and I was homeless living in my car. I just wasn't going to give them the satisfaction of knowing that I failed, or that's how I saw it. And I would have died rather than that happen. I was just going to keep going until I fell down, and I gave it my best shot. At the end of that 3 days, there were left, I think, nine of us outside of the office, and there was a sergeant or a colour sergeant inside, and he called seven people in, and the two or three of us that were left outside thought, oh God, these are the guys that have passed, and you know, we're going to get called in a minute and told, well done. We reckon we were going to get told, well done, fellas, but could you come back in 6 months? And then the guys came out and they disappeared silently, and we got called in, and the guy just said, right, fellas, pat yourselves on the back, you've all just joined the Royal Marines. I'd gone from having nothing. I couldn't see anywhere that my life was going, and I'd always been like that. To go from that to suddenly finding yourself a member of one of the world's most elite fighting forces was just immense. Probably for the first time in my life. I was, you know, I had something substantial to be proud about. Now, that's how I felt. Well, we all arrived on that infamous platform at Lincoln, and our drill instructor came down. He was a good guy. Yeah, he was good. We went for an interesting time, our training. It was just after the Falklands, it was 1988. The Falklands was obviously 82, so it was that period. It was a time that was remembered for being quite a lot of almost bullying, I guess you could say. The training teams were very hard on the guys back then, and you could get a troop of 55 people leave that railway platform on day one, and they'd get whittled down to 8 or 9 guys. You see some things that are not nice. On our first exercise, there was a guy walking around and he had the chin strap undone of his helmet. Anyone who's ever worn a helmet and needed to wear a helmet will tell you, you have the chin strap done up because it's pretty much gonna get blown straight off your head if you don't have them. To demonstrate this point, the corporal made this guy kneel down in front of everyone, and then he just repeatedly kicked him in the head. He actually had to do it about 4 or 5 times before the helmet did actually came off. I'm not sure if he meant to kick it off first time, but that was, it was a bit sad. You could see this poor lad was on the verge of tears, and he was a good lad as well. He went on to become a diamond, so it wasn't as if he really deserved it. And there's better ways to make your point. The guy that replaced him was fine. At the end of the 32 weeks, he did our 30-miler with us. It was interesting because all the way through our training, he showed up in the first sort of fortnight to 3 weeks, showed us the basics, and then every single time from then on, we would arrive as you do. I think it was sort of 2 or 3 times you needed to be on the drill square, and you could see his red eyes, and he'd walk towards you, and you just knew the guy had a hangover. And he'd say, "Right, fellas, go back to your block and do some admin." And of course, we were so exhausted, we were just praying he was going to say this anyway. And that meant that you could actually go back and lie on your bed for maybe an hour, which was unheard of in training. I mean, you woke up at 4, most nights I never got to bed before 1:30. Normally got out around 4, 4:30. So to have that extra hour, because our DL was always drunk the night before, was a real bonus. So, yeah, you could say drinking was quite a big pastime in the mains. Weekends in training where it's almost programmed into your routine to let you go downtown with your guys to sort of do all the bonding stuff. So we obviously did that. But it wasn't until I got to my unit that we'd go into Plymouth City Centre, sometimes every night, get really drunk. I mean, it's the first time I ever drank to get drunk, because I'd done that before. It was where I drank to get obliterated, and then seeing the people that had got up late in the morning, seeing the panic on their faces as they rushed to fall in, and people whispering, you know, your button's undone. But I drank for pleasure then, you know, despite drinking to annihilation, it still was for pleasure. There was never the, wow, I could really do with a drink aspect. I just never had that. Even drinking to that extent, I could still go in a pub set if I was driving and just have a pint and leave and not be thinking, oh my God, like, I don't just want to have one pint, I want to have another, and then preferably I want to have another, and then I want to have at least another before I go home. And then when I get home, I'd like to have some in the fridge. Of course, you never think you're going to be like that. And I was for 20 years. I said to my dad when I left to go to Lymston, and I looked him in the eye and I said, "Dad, I'm going to pass out as a Royal Marine Commando. And when I do, you are going to get the first invitation to my passing out parade. And you are going to see me as a Royal Marine. That was probably my biggest motivator above everything else. I'm not massively nostalgic, but one of the guys in our troop had got our passing out tape, VHS, transferred to digital. And he'd sent us all the link to download a copy. And so I thought, go on. And it's quite a spectacular day. It's spectacular for you as a Marine, let alone for parents who know nothing about, you know, that life. You march onto that parade square. You've got the band playing Life on the Ocean Wave. You're dressed in what has to be the smartest military uniform in the world. You've got your rifles over your shoulder and you're perfectly in time. And you do all these formation marches, which are actually quite easily done, but the audience isn't to know that. It's quite a show. And the troop officer said something like, "Marine Thrall, cope well with all aspects of training, blah, 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 blah. He's gonna be a real asset to 4-2 Commando." And I was like, wow, that's great, because I wouldn't have said that. I would have said, "Marine Thrall struggled like hell with every aspect of training and thought he was going to be binned at every single corner." I mean, I didn't have any major fear I wouldn't pass out, but you're generally made to feel that way, regardless. That's the kind of default for everyone, is you think you're going to fail, but I didn't especially think I was going to fail. Up until this point, my dad has not really shown any emotion. I think he was quite blown away with it all. And I went to get out the car and I just turned to him, and we didn't really do hugs in our family. In fact, I actually instigated hugs after all my drug problem. But yeah, he hadn't shown any emotion to this point. And I sort of turned around to shake his hand and he was just crying. And he threw his arms around me and he hugged me. And he said, "Son, I'm just so proud of you." And before I knew it, I was stood watching the car drive away, and I could still hear my dad crying as he pulled away. And yeah, that's something I don't forget.
"He coped well with all aspects of training. Despite a leg injury during the commando course, he still managed to pass all the tests. He joins 4-2 Commando, Marine Thrall."
Yeah, Northern Ireland was interesting, to say the least. Excited, yeah, but not that sense of excitement you get going to Disney World. You know, this is a job, you train for it. I had no fear. I've heard people say, you know, people go into war or active service, or they say they're not scared, they're lying. But I never was. I mean, I really wasn't. According to history, well, that was one of the most violent years on record. It was the 20th anniversary of British troops being in the province, and intelligence had it that the IRA were going to do all they could to kill a Marine. So I wasn't in trepidation. I just wanted to go over and get started, really, and see how it went. Before I knew it, we were being loaded up into these armoured vehicles. I don't even think we had our weapons with us. We were driving along and I'm looking out. Wow, this is Belfast. This is what it looks like. And I'm staring through this slit, and we drove past a pub. And all the guys were just chatting away, as you would be if you were in a closed vehicle and you couldn't see anything. But there's me. I'm staring at the guys outside this pub. The second we went by, they just all dropped their drinks, dropped their smokes, and just started searching around for anything to throw at us. As we were driving away, and I'm going, guys, they were still running down the road after us, just throwing chairs and bricks and stones and whatever. And that was the first time I thought, wow, this maybe is a bit serious. And we started off with M Company, a place called White Rock. The grime you see the second you get there tells you you're not in a Marines establishment. This is somewhere that a lot of soldiers have been through. Manky, pornography plastered on pretty much every surface. We've really got to be here for 5 months.
Coming home, Chris Thrall.
Forces Radio.
Had a year on an aircraft carrier. I'd say the most enjoyable time, like as for fun's sake, it was the most enjoyable time. I was the ship's DJ. I remember DJing a couple of shows as we were sailing to Barbados. And I was a bit like Adrian Cronauer on Good Morning Vietnam. I just had all these like voices that I'd make up. We had Bangkok Lady, and we had Dockyard Copper, and you could hear the ship's company just laughing all around the mess decks. It was fun, real fun. You know, things weren't politically correct at the best of times back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. You put a Royal Marine on the ship's radio and it gets worse. I had the chaplain pull me to one side the next morning, and very good show last night, Marine Thrall. But you can't take the mickey out of the captain like that. So I had some apologising to do on my next show. But it was brilliant. I got involved in a business, and the business was network marketing. It was marketing electronic products. One of the products was a personal attack alarm. And I knew that on a barracks with 500 Marines, most of whom saw their partners infrequently, selling the concept of security by this don't mess with me screeching alarm would be quite easy. And within the first week, I'd sold thousands of pounds worth of these alarms. I'd been promoted 3 times up the promotion ladder of this company. I started to think, wow, there could be a career here. I was in camp one day, and I saw my friend Flash. He was a military policeman. And I said, Flash, listen, you've been saying you're going to come to one of my business presentations for ages. Are you going to come or not? And he said, Chris, look, I'll be honest with you, it's not for me. But I met a guy on my military police course that it will be right up his street. He's in the Hong Kong Army. And I called him up. The next thing I know, I'm getting a phone call from one of the diamonds in the organization. That's the top position. That's what everybody aspires to. And it turned out that this guy Vance was high up in a company called Amway. And when I'd introduced him into this Quorum business, this state-of-the-art electronic products, he'd just picked the ball up and ran immediately with it. And he transferred a load of his people over that were already high-flying network marketers. And the thing went mad. I got lucky, and you've always got to have luck no matter what business you're in. And this guy had come good for me. So I didn't really have a hard decision to make. I had to leave, because if I didn't, how could I go out to Hong Kong and work where the biggest part of my business was? I think I started to see a side of the military, and that was this thing where if you had an aspiration to do what we call going outside, to go into Civvy Street, you know, to do something different, immediately you often get the response, oh, you can't do that. I mean, there's nothing out there for you. You can't just live your whole life in one job just because you're almost afraid to go and try something new. I mean, that can't be right. As my time neared to leave the Royal Marines, which takes 18 months because you have to serve out that notice period, certain individuals made it quite clear they weren't happy. And then we had a situation where a long-serving Marine, he became the subject of what I thought was a witch hunt, and they finally got him, so to speak, because his hair was half an inch too long, or that was the excuse. He served 3 months in prison. You've only got to do something that upsets the wrong person in the wrong place, and then you can see other people in their different ranks changing their behaviour to conform to the senior. Did I belong in the Royal Marines? I certainly had made a bed for myself elsewhere. The only problem was is that by the time I'd served my 18 months notice out, this business had started to crumble. And as I was leaving the train to go up and get my indulgence flight out to Hong Kong, I sat on the train and I knew it was all gonna go wrong. I just knew. And I went to the window of the train and I pulled the window down and I rolled a small spliff and I just smoked it out the window and I thought, come on, Chris, you know, you're going out to Hong Kong, you're smoking drugs on the train. This is gonna end in tears, isn't it? And obviously I knew the answer to my own question. I landed in Hong Kong and I was going to do my blag, which is to stay in HMS Tamar. I still had my military ID card because I'd explained to the clerk back at Stonehouse, like, listen, you know I'm out the Corps, but I'm still technically in for 3 months and I'm going to be in Hong Kong and I'm intending to stay in the barracks there. You know, I didn't tell him that I had no permission whatsoever. He wasn't interested anyway. He went, okay, well, keep hold of your card, post it back to me. Sure. I arrived in Hong Kong, I arrived at the barracks, I showed my card to the Gurkha on the gate, he came up and saluted me, which is just very endearing thing about the Gurkhas, they call everyone sir just to be safe. And I went in and I said, guys, are there any Marines around? And one of them sorted me out with accommodation. That evening I went to a business presentation. The products we were trying to market had just turned gimmicky and rubbish and they weren't sellable. So this director turned around and said to me, the problem is you. You and your distributors, they don't work hard enough. And I just smiled at the guy. I didn't even bother saying anything. I turned around and walked out the office doors. And I knew as I walked out, I was never going to go back. Sir, the adjutant is on the phone. And I thought, oh, no. I said, hello, sir. It is the adjutant.
So you are a mysterious Marine?
Yes, sir.
What the hell are you doing stowing away on our camp?
What's he going on about?
You will report to me right away. Do you understand?
I said, yes, sir. I mean, of course I understood. Whether I was going to report to him right away was just a different matter as far as I'm concerned. I ran back there, I flashed my ID card, I kept my head down, I went up to the 17th floor, I just grabbed my kit, I bundled it all into my bag and chucked it over my shoulder, head down on the lift, and I walked out that gate knowing that was it. I'd severed my ties now with the military forever, and I was a civilian. And I was a civilian in one of the most dangerous cities in the world with this feeling that something was going to go wrong. Unfortunately, my business partner, this guy Vance, that had built me this massive business in the Asia Pacific, said, you can come and live with me. You can come and stay with me and my wife. I looked in the paper, trying to find a job. The first advert was bodyguard required. Must be fluent in Cantonese or something like this. And I thought, well, I can speak one or two. You know, I can say hello and goodbye in Cantonese. That must qualify me as fluent. So I immediately set about writing a CV because I'd obviously not needed one for 7 years. And I'm trying to tailor my military skills to bodyguard skills. So I'm trained in unarmed combat and fluent with small arms. And then I screwed it up and threw it in the bin. It was likable celebrity was the advert. Bodyguard required for likable celebrity. So I rolled up this paper because I didn't want the likable celebrity to think like I'm this ex-military guy with small arms. And I fired off that. I never heard a single thing. But the next advert was for a company called Gun Wang Hong. So I'm there. I had the two English guys in the office came over and they introduced themselves and they took me for training. And as things do in Asia, you just soon get around to chewing the fat and talking about how is it to be living in Hong Kong and whatever. And the guy said, you know, he said, Chris, you know, we don't actually sell anything here. Like, what? He said, no, he said, Mr. Fang, he just wants us in the office because we've got white faces. So when customers fly in from abroad, he said, we're selling DRAM memory chips for computers, and when customers fly in from abroad, in Mr. Fang's sort of old ancient Chinese wisdom, he feels it looks really good to have white faces in the office because it makes them look like an international company. I haven't sold a single thing in 5 or 6 months. I haven't sold a computer chip. I haven't sold a transistor. I haven't sold any of the masses of Chinese junk the company also traded in. Just nothing. It was impossible. For someone who wasn't fluent in Cantonese, who didn't have a good grip on the market, I really was there just for my white face. And one afternoon, I went to take a pee, and as I got in the toilet, I smelt this strange smell. And my colleague came out of the cubicle. He was a guy called Neil Diamond. He'd come out of this toilet, and he said, Chris, do you like to do a bit of drugs? I said, well, you know, I'll give anything a try. He said, well, come in here. He said, have you ever tried this ice? I said, no, but I've heard about it, though. So he set this little crystal up on a piece of silver foil, and he heated it with a lighter, and I'd never seen this kind of stuff going on before. And he put this rolled up banknote in my mouth and just said, suck, suck. So I breathed in these vapors. Didn't think much of it. I mean, I just took a tiny bit. Went back to my desk. And as I sat down, I started to feel this incredible feeling. Finding that I'm starting to do it more and more. So I'm promising myself, I won't do that again for a while. And then I'm realizing I'm actually doing it 3 times a week. And each time I'd buy the equivalent of an English £10 worth. And that'd be enough to keep you more than high all night long, if not with some left over. When I finally came clean about it with my business partner, he'd said, Chris, do you do the drug? I said, yeah, Vance, I do. And he was like, no. And I was like, oh. And he just grabbed me and went, very bad, very bad. In Hong Kong culture, taking the drug when you've made your fortune, it's okay. But before you've made your fortune, it's very bad. People think you are a loser. You have to remember, it's an ancient culture. And that's very simplified way of how you might well look at drugs. If you take them before you're successful, you could mess your life up. When I got back to work the next day, there was a letter on my desk, and I almost knew what it was before I opened it. Dear Mr. Thrall, this company has no more need of your services. I took a job selling advertising space. Our job was to go into the high-flying businesses in Hong Kong, and we tried to sell them advertising space. My two fellow salesmen had been there a while. Said, Chris, do you know what really goes on? And I, of course I didn't. They said, that magazine there, you see there's 12 copies of it, you know, our business advertiser on the shelf. He said, that's it. Well, I said, well, what do you mean? We're supposed to be going into these companies telling them that this magazine goes to every single shop, it goes to every hotel, every library, it's posted out to everybody in the magazine. What are you saying? He said, so I'll go in, I'll do the spiel, I'll say, hi John, lovely office you got here. So about this advertising thingamajig, if you can just put your scrawl here. But I literally put the pen in their hand and kind of guide them to sign, and that's it, I'm out of there. So you go into someone's office, you sell them advertising space in a magazine that technically doesn't exist. So I did that. My first hit was British Telecom Hong Kong. And I went in, it all went perfectly to plan. Spoke to the managing director, did the, hi, nice office you got here. If you just sign here, and if I can just get out of here, yes! I did it, it was that easy. So cockily, going out the office for the afternoon, I said, guys, I'm going for a walk. I may be sometime. See if you can get a good price for my skis. And we all laughed, and I didn't know that it was literally I was going to be some time, because I went to a smaller company. It was a very nice English chap. He just took one look at the ad and said, "Chris, we never place that advert with you." He said, "If you just wait there, I'll go and get our invoices." And he disappeared up a flight of stairs, and I just ran for the lift. And I got lost as quick as I could in Hong Kong's masses. And I felt ashamed. I felt ashamed that I'd tried to cheat this hard-working man. I wandered into Wan Chai, and I wanted to go and see my friend who worked as a doorman on a Chinese-run club. So I wandered down into this club, and my friend wasn't there. I went up, introduced myself, and he said, "Oh no, Glenn's gone to Thailand." He said, "Can you do doorman job?" I said, yeah, I can do doorman job. He said, do you want to start here?" I said, "Yeah, I'd love to start here." Just typical, your first night on a new job. I didn't really know anyone, obviously didn't know anyone. The manager, Peter, came up to me and said, "I'll introduce you to your two workmates." 6 foot 6 guy, his name was Daisu. He introduced me to this short, chubbier chap called Chuchi. And I thought, okay, look forward to getting on with you guys like you do in the workplace. And later that night, I was walking past the bar and an English expat went, "Chris." I said, "Yeah, that's right." I was surprised he knew my name. He said, "So, you know they're all triads?" "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Your man Daisu there, the tool guy you were talking to earlier, he's an assassin. Every now and again, he gets smuggled over the border into China to do a hit on someone and smuggled back again." Well, I was just almost in shock. I was fascinated, I was fascinated. And he said, "Chuchai, your man there, he said he's a street fighter. He's what they call a little horse, a magi in Chinese. He's like a runner, but he's a street fighter and he'll pick up anything in a scrap. He thinks he can smash an enemy over the head with it." And he went one by one around the bar explaining all the positions that these triads have. And of course, found it fascinating.
Coming home, Chris Thrall.
It all went well. I was fascinated. I started to try and speak Cantonese with these guys, and they weren't having any of it. I'm sat on a stool by the door, which is where I found myself perching. And there were two prostitutes, two Thai prostitutes that had been sent over from another club to entertain the triad manager. So they were sat down having drinks, laughing. These two Thai girls were kind of showing off, in their element, because they were all with very important men. And then I looked over again and one of the girls just crashed on the floor. And then the other girl jumped astride of her. And I thought, it's horseplay, they're just mucking around, showing off in front of their dates. And then I looked again, and the face of the girl on the floor had started to go blue. And I realized, drug overdose. So being a former Marine, what do? You ABC, right? Instinctively. Couldn't tell if she was breathing at all. So I put my tongue next to her mouth, and I could just feel a light breath on my tongue. And I took her pulse, something like 160. And I thought, ice overdose, crystal meth. I grabbed her bag and I started looking through it to see what drugs were in there, figuring when the ambulance comes, I want to be able to tell them. And her friend just screamed and ripped the bag back. And I remembered back to what Vance had said about drugs being taboo in Hong Kong. And I thought, wow, this girl would rather her friend die than I tried to help her live. Next thing I knew, there were two sets of feet there. It was the triad boss, and the club owner had walked over. The triad boss just looked down at me and said, "Throw her in the alleyway." I thought, did I just hear that? He just told me to throw her like in the alleyway where the dumpsters were out back. And of course I wasn't gonna do that. So I just ignored him. It was just the only thing I could do. And I looked up and I looked around the bar expecting that people were going to rush over and help me, and everyone had just put their drinks down and they were all staring. It seemed like they were all staring at daggers at me. And there was one expat in the club. He said almost laughingly, "Are you all right, bud? Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, go to the 7-Eleven and call an ambulance." And he went, "Yeah." As if, yeah, like, right, someone hasn't done that already. And I said, look around you. The next day, one of the triads came over and said, "Do you want to come to breakfast with us?" And I thought, wow, this is really, you know, the other day I was homeless living out my backpack. Now I'm going to breakfast with a 14K, Hong Kong's most ruthless triad brotherhood. So, of course, I said yes, but I noticed not a single person spoke to me. I walked over to the Dilo, that means big brother, that's the triad boss, and I said, "The girl last night?" And he just nodded and looked straight ahead. I said, "Did I do the wrong thing?" He just nodded, and I knew that's all that was needed to be said. The next day I arrived at work, there's a Westerner stood there wearing a Club Nemo sweatshirt. He said, "You're Chris?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm Drick, short for Hendrick." And he spoke with a South African accent, and I was like, what are you doing here? He said, "Oh, Peter, the boss, just asked me to come over from the Pussycat Club for a few nights, you know, to help out." I said, "To help out?" I said, "This is about that girl last night, isn't it?" And he kind of took a furtive look around him and went, yeah, it is. I said, "Did I really do the wrong thing?" He said, "Yeah, you did." I said, "Well, what was I supposed to do? The girl was dying on the floor. I couldn't just let her die." He said, "What you do in that case is you just pick her up, throw her over your shoulder and run out and put her in a cab." That scenario hadn't even occurred to me. And I was like, "So is that the only reason you're here? I mean, just because I didn't put a girl in a cab?" And he said, "No." I said, "Go on." He said, "They think you're a cop." And I thought, have I really screwed this up? This suddenly had all taken a very serious turn. And I'd gone from being a happy-go-lucky, albeit very drug-addicted doorman, to suddenly feeling as though I was about to suffer the wrath of the triads. And I wouldn't be the first guy. My friend, who was a fellow doorman in Wan Chai, he had scars all over his face from where he'd been working on his club door one night. A transit van had pulled up. 7 triads got out with meat cleavers and they just began hacking him to bits. His thumb was so severed, it was just hanging down on a string by his wrist where he'd put his hands up to protect himself. And his face was crisscrossed. It looked like he'd been rammed into a tennis net at 100 mile an hour or something. And that turned out to be a case of mistaken identity. The next thing I knew, doormen from the other clubs are starting to come down our stairs. And they would stop next to me, look at me, give me the look of evil, then go into the club. Earlier in that week, I'd noticed when some of the expats came into the club, they would see this South African doorman that I mentioned, and they didn't think I noticed, but I did. When they came in, they'd cough, and he'd give a slight cough back. And it was so clever and so sly, if you weren't looking for it, you just wouldn't know. But it reminded me of when we were doing arms drill, like on our pass out parade in the Marines. And a lot of that drill was done without anyone giving commands, or at least it looked that way to the audience. What they didn't know is, hidden in the centre of the squad, we had a hissing Sid, and that was someone whose job it was to go and of course we would move on that command. So for anyone watching, it looked like we were performing magic. And this thing with the coughing really reminded me of that. So I became ever more confused, obviously. I think for the first time in my life, I started to get really scared. You know, who did I think I was? I started to do some thinking, and I thought, hang on a sec, I'm a former Royal Marines commando. What do these guys know about that? They think they're going to intimidate me? What are they expecting me to do? I thought, no, I'll stay and I'll fight. And I thought, no, I'm not having it. I reckon they're playing with me. And I still don't know to this day what it was truly about. I'd finally got back to my apartment block in Wan Chai. I went upstairs. In the midst of trying to figure all this out, I remembered a letter that I had, and I had it in my briefcase. And it was from my second cousin, Paul, who joined the Marines as a boy soldier and finally retired as a colonel. And I remembered something in it that was pertinent, so I rifled through my briefcase and I found this letter. And it said something along the lines of, "Dear Chris, blah, 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 when you're walking across Dartmoor and it's 3 a.m, pouring with rain, you might question what the hell you're doing, but I promise you, it will all be worth it in the end." And in my drug psychosis, my inner voice was telling me that the reason my cousin Paul had written those letters all these years ago was preparing me for this moment when I had to go up to the roof of the building, and I was on the top floor anyway, so, and I had to crawl across this wire that stretched between my building and the building on the other side of the Jaffe Road. So I got it in my head that, my God, we learnt the commando crawl in training. That's where you crawl across a rope, so that I could crawl across this flimsy wire, this whole thing would be over and I'd find out what my whole life was about, what this whole bizarre Hong Kong spirit experience was about, and it would all be done, dusted, finito. So up I went to the rooftop, I laid my body on this cable and I started shinning across. And I got a few feet out and I just stopped, and I'm looking down at the people, and they're like ants. I was so high up. And it was pitch black other than the obvious street lights below. And I'm swaying there, and I just suddenly thought, what if I fall? What if my brother back home has to hear that his brother became a drug addict in Hong Kong and he threw himself off this building? Because that's what they would report, right? They wouldn't know what I was up to. And I thought, how would it be if he hears that his brother threw himself off a building? It just hit me, and tears started pouring down my face, and I went back to my room, and I got angry then, you know. I was in such a rage. What the hell had I been thinking? What was I doing? I mean, those drugs, they were so good in the beginning. They'd really worked for me. They'd made me feel the person that I wanted to feel. They'd probably filled a big gap in my life. And yet, how had I turned out? What had I got now? I had nothing. So far away from what I would have been as a Marine just a year ago. Finally, I just sank down in a crying mess on the floor, and I just couldn't stop crying. The reality, for the first time in a year, of what I'd actually done to myself came home. I left the UK to make my fortune. Not just the money, of course, but just metaphorically, you know, to find myself. And I was going back a completely broken wreck. I landed at London Heathrow and I saw my dad. I stood there looking at the passengers coming off the flight. So I walked up to him and I said, "Hi, Dad." And he was kind of still looking as though, you know, who's this guy in my way? And he sort of stepped around me and kept looking. I said, "Dad." And he looked. And then he turned back again and kept looking at the passengers coming off the flight. I said, "Dad, it's me." And then he looked. And the shock on his face, you know, I just remember it to this day. I could see in his eyes he didn't recognize me. He just didn't recognize the person looking at him. So basically, you know, I was still very high. I still had drugs on me. They ran out after a few days. In those few days, the police were called 3 times. The only danger I was to myself. I wasn't going to hurt anybody. But my parents were so frightened by my behavior, they just couldn't understand it. So they kept calling the police. In reality, you have to get so fed up of taking drugs. And as you can probably tell from my story, I had gone lower than you're supposed to go. And you make a decision to change, and that day comes, and you quit the drugs. And it's not long before your addictive mindset starts saying, well, you know, you've done really well, you've given up for a few days, or it might be a few weeks, it might even be a month, you know. You can kind of treat yourself to some drugs now. Things were pretty fraught. I mean, I was a guy that just got kicked out of working for the Hong Kong triads because I was too crazy. And I mean, I was literally crazy. I don't mean my behavior was wild, although it was. I mean, I was just so mentally unwell, they couldn't deal with it anymore. They had to let me go. I was always just smoking a bit more of a drug or doing this, and I would always make sure I'd polish my boots when I went out and I'd have a wash, you know. I always stuck to my core marine principles, as it were. I was too messed up on the drugs to hold it together, and I just couldn't. And I can't believe how lucky I am. I have an amazing family. My partner Jenny is just the most wonderful human being I ever could have met. And our son, Harry, it was as if Mother Nature just want to design the most gorgeous little boy and then give him to us. And every night I go into his room and I look at him asleep in his cot, and I just tell him what I think of him, how much I love him, how proud I am that he's my boy, and that I'll never let him down. And that's really helped me to see who I am in a way.
You've been listening to Coming Home with Chris Thrall, and you can read more about Chris in his autobiography, Eating Smoke. The programme was produced and edited by me, William Warren. Executive produced by Mario Chrysostomy. This has been a Forces Radio BFBS production.
BFBS, original Forces programmes on digital radio, FM, and satellite TV in the UK.
Online and on air around the world.
This is Forces Radio.